Welcome back. Our guest this week on OTR is the state school superintendent, Dr. Michael Rice. And our lead story is a settlement in the Flint water crisis. On the OTR panel, Jonathan Osteen, Lauren Gibbons, and Zachary Gorchow. Sit in with us as we get the inside out, off the record.
Production of Off the Record is made possible in part by the following. Business Leaders for Michigan has a strategic plan to make Michigan a top 10 state in the nation for jobs, personal income, and a healthy economy. Learn more at michigansroadtotop10.com. And now, this edition of Off the Record with Tim Skubick.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to our Zoom edition of Off the Record with a great panel and a great guest. And we'll get to Dr. Rice in a little bit. But let's start out with this Flint water crisis settlement, which didn't come out of nowhere, but we knew it was in the works. But now we know for sure it's $600 million. Lauren, what did you make of all this?
I mean, this is a historic settlement for the state. They're saying it's likely one of the biggest, if not the biggest, in state government history. $600 million, most of that funding is going to go towards the youngest residents of Flint, the ones who were very young when the Flint water crisis began. So we'll see exactly how that plays out in the coming months, but it does appear as though the youngest residents of Flint are going to be the biggest beneficiaries of this money. It remains to be seen. I think it's kind of got mixed reactions in Flint. A lot of people are pleased that, you know, people are going to be getting something from the state for the water crisis, but, you know, there's still a lot of people who think, you know, more could have been done.
Yeah, Tim, it's such a momentous development after, you know, 6 years after the water change and, you know, 5 years after the controversy really exploded to, you know, finally have, you know, sort of major resolution. I mean, it can't be forgotten that the state fought this litigation tooth and nail during the, you know, the Snyder administration, you know, and not long after Gretchen Whitmer was elected governor, one of the lead attorneys, Michael Pitt, had said that, you know, she had indicated that there was an interest in finding a reasonable settlement. So this has been 20 months in the making. Now, I think there's a couple interesting pieces here. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency was not a part of the settlement, nor were firms that assisted the city with the switch of its water source to the Flint River, which of course led to the water crisis. They were not a part of this either. So the litigation there is going to go forward. And then of course, there's still the criminal investigation that's, who knows where it is now at this point.
Yeah, a lot of folks I talked to in Flint yesterday were sort of taking a wait and see approach, even though this sounds like a very big number that, you know, could provide a lot of meaningful assistance to families that are going to, with young children especially, that are going to be impacted by exposure to lead for, you know, a long, long time. There's still a lot of skepticism. I mean, you know, Flint residents, as we all know now, have developed a very strong sense of mistrust, not just to government, but to institutions as well. So there's some skepticism over, you know, for instance, how much money is going to go to attorneys, how much money are individual families actually going to qualify for. And a lot of that's up in the air still because, you know, the cut per family, if you will, is going to depend on how many people join the class action lawsuit, how many people decide to participate. One of the wrinkles here in this agreement, you know, not unsurprising, but is that folks who accept the settlement agreement will waive any other liability against the state, against state agencies, and against state officials, for instance, like former Governor Rick Snyder. So, you know, folks are still trying to figure out what's going on. And as Zach mentioned, you know, even if they're happy about this settlement, the number one concern that that folks raised to me yesterday was still the prosecution. You know, I mean, it's been over a year since Attorney General Dana Nessel and her team dropped ongoing charges against state and local officials. And they relaunched an investigation. It's possible new charges could still come, but there hasn't really been any noise on that front. A lot of folks in Flint are still seeking accountability there as well. So a lot of balls still up in the air, but obviously a big development for Flint residents and a big development for the Whitmer administration and Dana Nessel too. You know, they both came into office saying that they were going to take a different approach to Flint, and we hadn't really seen any tangible evidence or much tangible evidence of that until this week. You know, they had, you know, ostensibly been negotiating this settlement for, I think, something like 18 months, attorney said yesterday. So we know just last week when there was a lot of buzz around whether Whitmer would be the vice presidential selection, a lot of African-American voters brought up Flint, and they said the governor still hasn't done much on Flint despite these promises. So it's a big development for the administration as well.
One of the big questions yesterday, how much is everybody going to get? And nobody can answer that question because each one of these is an individual case. And for the people of Flint who think they're going to walk into an office building and sign a piece of paper and get a check from the state, think again, because as Michael Pitt, one of the lead attorneys on this case, explained yesterday, there's a lot of medical hoops that people will have to jump through to prove that they deserve the money. And then the dollar amount will be basically decided on who's got the worst case. Like, if, for example, you had five kids with lead all exposed, you're probably going to get more with a single parent who lived in a house in Flint. And so the numbers are yet to be resolved, but not lost here. And I think you guys make a good point here. One of the people that I talked to last night that was on the inside, they said, what a refreshing change of attitude from the Snyder administration to the Whitmer administration, which actually came into office saying, we want to settle this case. I remember talking to the governor last December about this. And she really wanted to get this resolved. And the $600 million figure had been on the table for quite a while. And there were some other moving parts that they didn't resolve. One of them was these two engineering firms that were supposed to originally be part of this settlement. But then it came to a point, I'm told, that they just decided, well, that's not going to work out. Let's not hold up the rest of the people in Flint because of those folks. Let's take them out of the equation and go for the settlement. And so we have it. Now, the question is, Lauren, $600 million bucks in a climate where we don't have a lot of money laying on the floor, where does it come from?
Yeah, and I think that's a huge aspect of this, right? We've already talked on this show quite a bit about the major budgetary issues that the state is currently facing due to the coronavirus primarily. You know, there's already a lot of concerns, like, is there going to be enough money to, you know, fund schools, fund public safety and healthcare and other critical aspects of the budget? So now to throw a $600 million settlement figure into that equation is going to make the budget process even more complicated. We have about a month before, a little over a month actually, before lawmakers and the administration have to come to conclusion on this. They're still kind of waiting and seeing if any federal funding is going to be made available. But, you know, it's starting to come down to the wire, and it's going to remain to be seen how it seems as though there's a little bit less of a budget deficit coming up. We'll see next week exactly what that figure is. But even if the revenue situation is a little bit better than was predicted a couple months ago, it's still pretty bad.
Yeah, if you look at it right deficit now, originally. Oh, go ahead, Tim.
No. Please, Eric.
You know, originally in May, they were forecasting a deficit of $3 billion for the upcoming fiscal year that starts October 1. But with the pushed back tax deadline to July 15 instead of April 15, they really are getting a much better handle on what current year revenues are looking like. And it's looking like the deficit's going to be more in the $1 to $1.5 billion range, which is still pretty terrible, but not unfathomably crushing like $3 billion. So if Congress and the president don't come through with relief to the states, which right now you'd have to bet against that happening, The state, the legislature, and the governor are going to have to come up with a solution that doesn't rely upon more federal aid.
I don't think there's ever a great time for the state budget, you know, to take a $600 million hit. But especially, you know, it's a very, very difficult times, as everyone mentioned. I'm really fascinated. So the consensus revenue estimating conference is next week. That's what Lauren and Zach were talking about. I'm really fascinated to see what sort of considerations they make. So as Zach mentioned, revenue for July did come in well above expectations. But, you know, this is the last month where folks in Michigan, at least for now, were qualifying, unemployed folks were qualifying for $600 a week extra in federal assistance. That the best case scenario is folks might qualify for $300. The Whitmer administration has applied for a new assistance program through a Trump executive order, but there's a lot of questions. So that revenue that Zach mentioned is for this year, but next year, you know, if folks don't have assistance, if there's still a lot of jobless people, the real impact of the layoffs is going to hit the economy still coming up, in the future. You know, the federal assistance, the CARES Act really blunted some of the impact, a significant amount of the impact to the economy. And if the federal government doesn't come through with more assistance, we're going to see that impact to a greater extent, I think. So these folks, budget experts who have to make these projections next week, they've got a lot of work cut out for them. And of course, there's going to be another one of these things too later this year. So it's not the end of the story, but this is certainly an unprecedented exercise in trying to figure out what kind of money the state can expect to come in.
All right, quickly, before we call in Dr. Rice, Zach, bring us up to date on where we are on COVID. Is it winning or are we winning?
I don't think we're winning. I think that's pretty clear, unfortunately. After this rise that began in the middle of June in Michigan new cases, it's flattened out a little bit in the last few weeks, but hasn't started declining. Michigan's doing a lot better than a lot of other states in new cases and in deaths. And certainly in hospitalization, the hospitalization rate has stayed has not gotten anywhere near a danger zone. So those numbers all look pretty good, but it's not like cases are declining back down to nothing. And we have a few counties in the state that are having a problem in cases right now, maybe not in hospitalizations, but especially along the Upper Peninsula's border with Wisconsin, the per capita rates of cases are much higher than in the rest of the state. This is largely believed to be because residents of those counties are going into Wisconsin, which has very loose restrictions right now, and bringing the virus back with them. The only real big positive is that the hospitalizations haven't shot up like they did in March and April.
Lauren, what did you make of the numbers this week?
I think it's just continuing to show that it's something to be monitored and something to, I think there's some signs of optimism, but there's also just, it's very, it's just a very huge problem that continues to obviously impact policy. We saw some major shifts in university policy, what the MSU is going online. A lot of schools are going online only. A lot of people are still very, very worried about potential new clusters forming, especially in areas where people are expected to be congregating. Ann Arbor is watching it quite closely too with the fall semester. So I think there's still a lot of balls up in the air that could substantially change where things are going. A lot of experts are also concerned about the possibility that The fall, the flu season could also potentially impact how the numbers for coronavirus change as well. So it does seem as though there's a lot of factors that could really change the situation very quickly if they're not monitored closely.
Which is a nice lead into our guest who's going to join us now, who didn't sign up for dealing with this COVID thing, I'm going to guess, Dr. Michael Rice. Doctor, thank you for joining us on OTR, sir.
Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate it, Tim.
All right, let's let Jonathan have the first toss-up.
Yeah, Dr. Rice, so over the weekend, the legislature and the governor, finalized an agreement to put some rules in place for school reopenings. Obviously, they didn't really, they left it up to districts to decide whether they want to be in person or remote, but made a lot of other changes, some of which gave at least administrators some heartburn. How do you think that, that issue resolved itself? And our schools, do they have enough guidance right now from the state on how to pull this thing off?
Well, Jonathan, first of all, thank you for the question. It's legislation in divided government. There's going to have to be some measure of compromise. Everyone is not going to be happy. In fact, everyone is going to be perhaps unhappy about something in it. There's markedly more clarity, however, than there was just a few days ago. Clarity on days, hours, attendance, and enrollment, all of those building block parameters for local school districts are decided. Days and hours requirements waived for the year, a formula associated with the calculation of attendance, formula associated with the calculation of enrollment. And with respect to those parameters, they are largely, not perfectly, but they're largely what the seven major education organizations and I recommended in June. Not perfectly, but largely. There are some things in the legislation, inevitably, that got in that some people aren't going to like. You're going to see that. I myself don't care for the requirement to go back in front of a board month after month after month for a revisiting of the plan. I think that's something that any local school district, there are 831 local school districts in our local control state, any one of those local school districts could have decided to do on a monthly basis if it felt the need, but to require 831 school districts to do that, I think that that's overkill. But in general, I think it provides a lot more clarity, more certainty, more stability than what we had prior to last week. Certainly better than 6 weeks ago, better even than 3 weeks ago, what was passed in the House, the four pieces of legislation that were passed in the House that ultimately became the three in the Senate, and then finally with concurrence from the House and the signature from the governor.
Lauren?
Yeah, so a lot of districts, when this legislation was going through, were very concerned about the prospect of using any amount of current counts for enrollment as a tie-in to state funding. So it ended up being this 75-25 number, basing most of it on last year's enrollment, but a little bit still on this current year's enrollment. Could you talk to us a little bit about the current trends that you're seeing as in districts? Or is there a real reason to be concerned that student counts will be substantially lower this year?
I think it's going to be, Lauren, district by district. Again, there are 831 LEAs in the state. There are 534 traditional public school districts, 297 public school academies. I think it's going to be different in different corners of the state, depending upon what local school districts offer in person, at a distance, a hybrid, if at a distance, synchronous versus asynchronous. So the effect on count is really going to be a function of the individual districts or districts in a given region. I will tell you that I was advocating for going solely on last year's count this year and not requiring districts to do the two counts that are traditional or typical in state law. I felt like in order to have some measure of stability in a pandemic, we ought not to have any counts that we should simply use for revenue purposes, last year's blended count in this year. Again, compromise and divided government, close to that, but not perfectly at 75-25. I think it could have been a lot worse, could have been a little bit better.
Zach?
Superintendent Rice, there's always such a push and pull between local control versus clear standards across the state. It almost seemed like in this case, a lot of the districts were saying, we need to know what to do from the state. But yet, this is a plan that pretty much leaves, you know, school boards and superintendents and all of these districts and each public school academy in charge. Are you comfortable that with the direction this is going? Because it seems like it's turning into a huge patchwork across the state where you have a lot of districts going to online only, but then districts right next door are using a hybrid system. Some are doing live instruction. Some are doing, you know, they've got teachers record a lesson and the kids can, you know, watch that whenever. It definitely seems like, you know, children across the state are going to be getting wildly different experiences.
It is Zach, in fairness, it's a manifestation not only of the local control nature of our state, but the local control nature of our country as well. If you look at this across the country, you see this playing out in 14,000 districts across the country where neighbors are having very, very different experiences for neighbors' children. So you will see over the course of the year, parents choosing based on what makes best sense for their children. Not that they don't want to necessarily stay in their home district. Many will, many do, and many, many will. But there will be some that change because they feel as if their child needs in person, their local school district isn't offering it, or just the opposite, that their local school district is offering solely in person, or for all intents and purposes, solely in person, and they really prefer education at a distance. So it's a local control state, yes, but it's also a local control country in the way in which we do public education. And you see that in substantial measure, in extraordinary measure, sort of on steroids, if you will, in the midst of a pandemic.
Dr. Rice, 91% of the teachers in Detroit voted for a safety work stoppage called /strike. Are those illegal, sir, if they do that?
So they authorized a strike. They didn't vote to strike. They authorized a strike. What I believe in is the importance of labor and management working together. I think that labor and management are talking in Detroit. And my hope is that they will conclude their negotiations and that the hypothetical that you raised, Tim, will not have to be bridged.
But if it is, if they do not show up for work, are they breaking the law?
If they don't show up for work, that is normally a challenge. It does prompt the question what it means in the midst of a pandemic if there is work from home.
Let me just try once more, okay? Are you saying there's some legal ambiguity as to whether a work stoppage because of a COVID is different than a work stoppage because we have a disagreement on something else?
I'm saying that I believe in the importance of labor and management working together. They are working together. It is my hope that they will arrive at a resolution and that the 50,000 students in DPSCD will be well served moving forward. Recognize that districts across the state are making individual decisions right now about what to do with their young people. I'm not going to engage in a hypothetical about what if the DFT operates in a particular fashion and what ought to be if the DFT operates in a particular way. I think the teachers have not just the right to have their voices heard, they have the responsibility to have their voices heard. They are, after all, our frontline workers, along with support staff in our schools. And I think there's an importance for labor and management to do what they're doing, which is talking, working it out.
All right, we have about 2 minutes left, and we're going to do it. Yeah, go ahead. I'm just going to say we're going to do an overtime, so go ahead, Jonathan, 2 minutes.
Sure.
Yeah, Dr. Rice, the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services this week said there were 14 known outbreaks associated with educational facilities, meaning schools or colleges, universities. But it won't say where those are or what facilities are involved. Do you know, and shouldn't the public have a right to know what K-12 schools have seen outbreaks?
I do not know. To the question, however, of the publicness of that data, I think what will inevitably happen as a longtime local superintendent is that either through formal media or informal media, the word will seep out. If you tell a mother that a child has tested positive or vice versa, that information is going to get out. It's going to get posted on social media. It's going to find its way into formal media. And there will be inevitably a record put together, whether it is informal across the state or a more formal record across the state. So the public will have the opportunity to access that information community by community. I think, Jonathan, your question really is there a value to the aggregation of that data? One could certainly make that argument. I think this is being reviewed in the administration, and I would hope over a period of time that the reflection is that since it's going to inevitably come out local jurisdiction by local jurisdiction, it probably serves us to have a more central repository thereof.
All right, let's pause right there. We'll do these close credits, and then we invite you in the audience to return to WKAR.org for more Off the Record Overtime with Dr. Michael Rice. See you right there after this.
Production of Off the Record is made possible in part by the following. Business Leaders for Michigan has a strategic plan to make Michigan a top 10 state in the nation for jobs, personal income, and a healthy economy. Learn more at michiganswroadtotop10.com. For more Off the Record, visit WKAR.org. Michigan public television stations have contributed to the production costs of Off the Record with Tim Skubick.